So Dan Quinn says the Commanders would, quote, never shut the door on Bobby Wagner. Nick Ashew on the Fan, that is the right decision. I know Bobby Wagner was kind of the pinata for a lot of fans this year, which in a vacuum, sure, he was bad in coverage and was exposed quite a bit. But considering where that defense was and considering what he still brought to the table, fans should be begging for this team to bring him back. Not to play every down, not at a big contract. Bobby Wagner brings everything that this team still needs except, well, you know, being exposed in pass coverage. So Dan Quinn says we'd never shut the door on him. He told us to John Keim. We do feel like there's some players that are about to take off at his position, which is absolutely true. Look, they've went out and they've made some additions, right? We all know that. The Commanders got younger. The Commanders got to a point where they've addressed at least some of the needs that were there. I still think this defense is a long way to go. Maybe you get a better Frankie Louvu next season. I mean, Leo Chenal, is he going to be somebody that you actually can see develop and grow in front of you moving forward? I mean, there's a lot. They've gone out and made some of the... Bobby Wagner still has value on this team. Some of it is from a leadership perspective. One of the best leaders and one of the smartest football players, and just one of the smartest people in the NFL. He brings value to what Jaden Daniels can do and grow and develop it, because he's really taken him under his wing and he's giving him a perspective from a linebacker. Here's what you're showing me. Here's what we're doing. Here's how you can learn from what Mike linebacker is going to show. Like, all of that stuff. That is vital. Oh, also, by the way, Bobby Wagner knows how to tackle, which, yes, they've improved. You still need everybody you can that actually knows how to tackle. Bobby Wagner had 162 tackles last season. That's fifth most among every single player in the NFL. That has value. 9 quarterback hits, 8 tackles for a loss, 4.5 sacks, 4 passes defended, 2 picks. Those are numbers that are worth bringing back next year for this team. The role needs to be smaller. The role needs to be a little less. And I think everybody would agree with that, probably even Bobby Wagner himself. He was out there getting a significant amount of snaps out of necessity. He was still one of their best defensive players last year. Is that saying much given what the ceiling was? It wasn't very much. But Bobby Wagner still brings significant value to this defense that if the role is used right, if he's put in the right position, and again, if it's 3rd and 7, I don't want him out there on the field. He's going to get exposed in pass coverage. You know a team's going to be throwing. It's just not a situation that's going to be good for him. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't still bring that value that they're going to need. And again, when you got some younger guys on this roster too, especially defensively, that helps. Leo Chenal has a chance to be a really good linebacker. I mean, he could be somebody that is one of the faces of this defense down the road. He's already won 2 Super Bowls, 44 career starts at just 25 years old, coming from Kansas City, one of the winningest franchises that we've had since Patrick Mahomes got there. Oh, and by the way, they were winning before that with Alex Smith as their quarterback, so it's not like it was a new thing for the Chiefs to start winning. They were winning for a while. And you bring some of that just culture that's on top of that. So Leo Chenal could be somebody that really brings a lot of value to this defense. And who better to help make him better than Bobby Wagner? Look, I get it. Bobby Wagner pissed you off sometimes, but you know what? He still matters to this defense. Everything is about price, right? Like, everything comes down to that in free agency, in trading back in the draft. What are you going to get in return? If you're going to trade up, what does that look like? All of those things, it really comes down to price every single time. It's the same thing with Brandon Ayuk. This team right now, the price is waiting first. The price is waiting for the Commanders on the 49ers and seeing what they're going to do. Are you going to get held hostage? Is this going to be a situation that's really worth it where you don't draft a wide receiver because you know Ayuk, it's all a formality and he'll be here and it's a 1-year, $15 million deal with a team option for year 2 or something along those lines? All right, and there's some value there. If we're talking like a 3-year deal with a ton of money guaranteed for Brandon Ayuk after not playing in 18 months, I don't think they're going to do that, but I'm just saying, for perspective's sake, that's not going to be valuable. You're not going to trade for Brandon Ayuk, because that obviously involves price, giving up something. That's never going to happen. So, you know, every decision that's made by a team is based on price. It's based on the value. It's based on what you need to do in that moment. And listen, even if the Commanders were to draft Sonny Styles, I think you still have Bobby Wagner back on this team. Yeah, we're starting to talk about roster positions here, but like, listen, What if Cade Medrano just can't make the roster and he just looks terrible in training camp? Maybe you cut him and Bobby Wagner stays and takes that job. Jordan McGee, what if he doesn't develop and grow and take that next step? Bobby Wagner fills that role for another season and you're looking for another young linebacker. There's also a chance they draft a linebacker. There's also a chance that, you know, this roster looks very different. Other guys are on the market come training camp and after training camp. All of this. There's so much there where, to me, Bobby, and even if you're Bobby Wagner, right? Doesn't he look at this and maybe say, this is still a good spot for me to be in late in my career? It's an organization that's trending up. We know how well this front office, this ownership group, this coaching staff is respected by players. We saw the report cards, right? The report cards matter. So with all of this kind of put together, you're in a position, if you're the Commanders, to really say, yeah, he absolutely still holds value to this team. And I think that that's the right choice. Look, you got to have guys. Not everything is going to be about what happens on the field. And I know that sounds crazy, right? Because it's really frustrating when you see that and you watch this team lose 12 games and you go, well, yeah, it matters on the field. I mean, it does. But you do have to have that level of locker room and leadership continuity that also extends in practice, in habits built during the week. And coaches can only tell you so much. It really helps when a future Hall of Famer like Bobby Wagner is telling you, this is how things are done, and this is how you'll succeed. Young players listen. It's just, and it's not even necessarily like you're bringing guys in that, like, well, if they don't get the coaching, they'll never figure out. It doesn't mean that that's not the case, but it's also helping them succeed more. We talk so much, right, about how important it is for a young quarterback to be in a position to succeed. Good offense and coaching and continuity and talent around him and a well-run organization, all of those matter, but it's not just a quarterback. It's more polarizing. Because quarterback's the center of the universe in the NFL. And if your first-round pick at quarterback doesn't pan out, everybody can lose their jobs. But you also still have other young players that hold valuable positions and valuable roles on a team that you're going to need to also be put in a position to succeed and grow. When you got a 25-year-old linebacker on a 3-year deal, you want to see Leo Chenault exceed those expectations. And it doesn't have to be just necessarily linebacker. I mean, Dafe Owe could learn from Bobby Wagner, too. He's still young in this, and there's a lot of pressure on Dafe Owe. You sign a $100 million contract, even if a lot of it's not guaranteed. I mean, that's important. That's really going to be something that they're going to have to, you know, they're going to have to make sure works out, because it's Dafe Owe is a guy that's on, I mean, in a position where there is a lot of pressure, and it's based on a small sample size. Because for the most part, I mean, there's a reason why Baltimore traded him at the deadline, right? They traded him because he wasn't living up to the expectations. Now, Baltimore's defense was an issue, which is weird to say, but he wasn't in the best position to succeed there. We saw what happened with the Chargers and all the sacks, and you went, okay, there's potential there. That's why Washington gave him the money that they did. But that now has to translate into success on the field and the development that's there. So it's having those veterans that are also a part of it, right? We look at Duke. Duke's playing today at 5. What did I say, right? They've been doing the one and done since it was a thing. Coach K bought into it, and good for him, right? It worked. But you can't have just one and done. Then you're Kentucky with Calipari. And it's like all freshmen starting, and you have absolutely no experience in March Madness, and I don't care how great your guard play is. When you don't know how to handle close games late, and you're missing free throws, and that all matters. You have to have a mix. It's a good balance, and it's the same thing for the Commanders, where the young... You got younger, you got faster, you got more athletic. Hopefully Sonny Styles is drafted, and you even add more to all of those things. But you got to have the veterans mixed in. You got to have some of the other leadership that's there. And that's the type of stuff that really matters. I mean, Akello Witherspoon, they just signed him. There's a lot of upside there, but some of that's based on injuries. So they've added a little bit more in terms of, you know, veteran corners on this roster, right? Like Amik Robertson and... You know, with Trey Amos already there and somebody you hope to see him take the next step, and Mikey Samristil is, a next step for him. And, you know, Nick Cross is a younger guy, too. So they went out and got younger, and it's all upside. It's so much upside with this defense to where if they're a middle-of-the-pack team, just a middle-of-the-pack team defensively, and that offense stays healthy, and most importantly, Jaden Daniels stays healthy. This is a double-digit win team. I really believe that the Commanders could win 10 games next year. Also, the schedule. It's not going to be as tough. It's just how it works. That's why you have these teams that go from worst to first. Because they improve in an offseason. Maybe they draft well or some other changes are made. The schedule helps, and that's why you see these big jumps in win totals. So Washington's in a spot where there is a big jump. These Commanders have an opportunity to really make that jump. Now, do I think that they are a team that's, you know, top three in the NFC? Of course not. I'm not jumping that far. But this draft and drafting well could also help with that. It could help with that, you know, adding some of these other pieces here. And they're going to look, they're going to get guys offensively too. They're going to probably draft a wide receiver. Whatever round it is, they're going to probably draft a receiver. You know, they're kind of set on tight end at this point now. I think they're good. I know everybody wants to see running back, but if you have Rashad White and Jerome Ford and Ja'Cory Crosby-Merritt and Jeremy McNichols, that's a backfield that you can do enough with because you have Jaden Daniels running the football also. So it's, there's just like, this team is on the cusp of making us forget what happened last year. But they also have to stay healthy, which is everything, right? That's every team in the NFL. We see it. Eventually, it caught up to the 49ers. Eventually, it caught up to the Chiefs. It's, I mean, it becomes something for everybody. It's like right on that cusp, though, with this team. All right, we got a couple more Elite Eight games coming up this afternoon. We'll talk to PJ Glasser next. Nick Ashew on the Fan. Nick Ashew on the Fan. We got two more March Madness games coming up today in the men's tournament. We had Arizona get past Purdue last night. A lot of one seeds still involved with Duke and UConn at 5 today. Michigan-Tennessee is the first game, about 2:15 or so. Looking at 1-6 seed, that's what we go with. Iowa getting knocked out. It's slowly dwindling away. PJ Glasser jumps on with me now. Game Day Garage, Hoops in 5. Give him a follow on all the socials. This is his favorite time of year. There's nobody more tied into college basketball than anybody, like than PJ Glasser. And I want to start with last night first, buddy. Arizona-Purdue. Once again, it's Purdue. This is where it goes every single year. People try to justify PJ, Purdue doing something, and then they always let you down. Though at least it was a Sweet 16 this time around. Your thoughts on what Arizona did to Purdue last night?
I mean, that second half, Nick, I think, you know, everybody, myself included, who picked Arizona when the brackets came out to win the national championship, like last night just justified why Arizona is going to be so tough to beat. It felt like they kind of played their B game. They certainly played their C-minus game in the first half. They really didn't hit that many threes from the outside. They weren't all that efficient from two, but they just come at you. They're so tough to keep off the free throw line. Their defense is so good. And they just go on those big runs. Purdue was up 7 to halftime. They were a pick 'em at the intermission. And it looked like, oh, man, is Arizona really going to blow this opportunity? And they just came out in the second half and turned it into another gear. So that was really the big takeaway. You know, Purdue came at them early. They gave them a great first punch. They were winning going into the locker room. But Arizona, they never panicked, and got to give a lot of credit to them. They're going to be a tough out. You know, I told you at the beginning I thought they were the best team and they would win it all. I still feel that way, and we'll see how things go today with Michigan and Tennessee in that game. But that could be a heck of a Final Four matchup.
All right, the winner of the Michigan-Tennessee game today will then see Arizona. So what is a better matchup for Arizona to advance between Michigan and Tennessee? I'm assuming Tennessee, or am I going to be wrong there?
No, for sure. Yeah, Tennessee, if they played Tennessee, they'd probably be like a 6.5, 7.5 point favorite in that game. They played Michigan. If they play Michigan, that's probably a pick 'em. And, you know, what would be so interesting about that game, Nick, is both those teams are two of the best front courts in the country. Both teams have great size. Both teams have great depth. But Michigan, what's been impressive with them so far through their first three games is how efficient they have been up to this point from the three-point line. I mean, they've been shooting the ball like 50% from deep. That's why I think it's such an interesting matchup today against Tennessee. The Vols under Rick Barnes, I mean, they are as good as anybody at defending the three-point line. If they're able to limit Michigan today and their three-pointers, they're able to kind of muck this game up. They're the number one offensive rebounding team in the country. They're able to do that, give themselves some extra possessions, and shut Michigan down from three-point range, it could be an interesting game. But that's why I think they're a good matchup for Arizona, because Arizona doesn't really shoot a lot of threes, whereas that maybe could be the challenge for Michigan today. They've been so good from three-point range. If Tennessee is able to limit those three-pointers, are they able to win a game against the Vols where they don't rely on their three-pointer. I think they will, but that's certainly what I'm looking forward to today.
All right, talking to P.J. Glasser, Duke and UConn tips off a little after 5 today. They will, of course, whoever wins that will advance and see Illinois. Listen, we know people love or hate Duke, P.J. This is how this thing works. But Duke's talented, and they overcame that 10-point deficit in the second half against St. John's. Does this game today against UConn for Duke come down to who wins the matchup in the paint?
Probably. You know, UConn, they want everything to go through their big man, Terrace Reed, and he's really good. I felt it interesting, you know, Michigan State and Izzo, they decided to play Reed one-on-one. And Hurley and the Huskies were trying to feed Reed as much as they could in the second half. I would look for them to do that same thing today. Duke's got maybe the best defense in the country, and they trust their big men down low, Ngumba, Malik Brown, Cam Boozer. They trust those guys in one-on-one defense. So are they going to have to make adjustments as the game goes on? Do they double Terrace Reed? That's the chess match I'm kind of interested in today. But, yeah, I think the paint presence is going to be important. And, look, I mean, as cliche as it is, like, Duke's defense is so good, you're going to have to knock down perimeter shots. That's why it looked like for a while there, St. John's was going to pull the upset the other night. They were hitting their threes. UConn here for the last month or so has not been that great of an outside shooting team. They shot it well against Michigan State. They're going to have to do the same thing again today against Duke.
You know, when we're looking at college basketball here, P.J., you and I have talked about this a bunch recently. You know, we don't have, at least this tournament, and really the last couple of tournaments, we haven't had as many, you know, Cinderellas and upset. And some of that's marketing, right? Like, we just know that sometimes that's what makes it fun and exciting, and the casual fans like, ooh, I love upsets. I'm still convinced that we're in a good spot in college basketball now where there's parity near the top, but you're not looking at this where it's a bunch of double-digit seeds getting to an Elite Eight where, and again, I know it's different for you because you are hardcore into this, but I think a lot of the casual fans want to see the Dukes and the UConns and a lot of these blue bloods just because it's familiarity, and you got a bunch of guys that you're going to see in the NBA draft, and like all of this kind of ties in. When you look at where college basketball is in terms of NIL, in terms of transfer portal, in terms of what we've seen in the tournament, does this kind of feel like the evolution that's there, or could you still see opportunities where we have a tournament where it's a ton of double-digit seeds and maybe more upsets and Cinderellas, if I'm going to put it in broad terms, than usual?
Yeah, I think it's still too early to tell. I would certainly think that, you know, the days of like Loyola Chicago making a deep run or like St. Peter's, those are probably hard to come by. Just
George
because,
Mason,
again,
my George Mason, Peach, that's what you're saying?
No, I don't think George Mason, Nick, I don't think that's going to be happening. But look, I mean, look how close we came to Siena upsetting Duke in the first round, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were up 11 at halftime. If they just were able to have some semblance of a bench and just give their starters a breather, they had Duke on the rope. So, again, we're so quick to overreact. Everybody was so quick to overreact that this tournament was going to be so boring and so bad, and it's turned out to be awesome. And, again, like the question I keep posing to people is, look at the matchups we have today, right? How excited is everybody to watch this Duke-UConn game? Whereas, like, Michigan and Tennessee, we all think maybe Tennessee can keep it close. We think that probably Michigan is going to end up winning the game. But even so, like, would you want to see Michigan against, like, you know, St. Peter's today? Or do you want to see Michigan against, like, Iowa State? Would that have been fun? Or Michigan against Virginia, whatever it was in that region? So that's why I think the tournament is kind of bulletproof. You know, like, if you get the mid-majors and the Cinderella stories, it's an awesome national story, and that's why I think a majority of people tune into March Madness. But I think for most of us, like, we're not complaining that we get to see Duke and UConn battle it out today for a trip to the Final Four. I think we're going to get more of those types of matchups. We've certainly got them the last 2 years, and they've been great. But yeah, Nick, I think we'll see some first-round upsets. Maybe some teams make Sweet 16 runs, but, like, Elite Eight, Final Four for those George Mason, Loyola Chicago, I think those are going to be tough to come by.
PJ, I just want to let you know that twice during this show today, only twice, I have done an official lottery sim, and the Wizards have gotten the number one pick in both of the lottery sims that I've done. Now, obviously, the NBA is going to be changing this. We all know it. I don't know how much you've paid attention to the various differences that they may be throwing out there, smoothing out the odds, all of that. But let's just look at some of these guys now as we get you know, closer to the NBA draft here, because you've watched AJ DeBanza closely and Darren Peterson and Cameron Boozer and, you know, guys even farther down those big boards necessarily, like a Darius Acuff, who I think is probably going to be elevating himself with the way that he's played in this tournament. And I think you probably agree. I know we've talked about him some, but when you look at all of the hype around this draft class, to me, it's not just about the top end, the DeBanzas and the Petersons and, you know, some of those names that are getting thrown out there, but I think it's the depth even on the back half of the lottery for the NBA draft where, you know, you start talking about a Keaton Wagler who might even be a top five when it's all done. Or I mean, again, I could go down the list of some of these names, but does it feel like it's not, because this is what I see. Do you see a draft also that's not just top heavy with franchise altering potential talent, but also depth on the back half of the lottery too, like I do?
100%. Because usually, you know, when we've had years where it's like these generational can't-miss prospects with the Zions and the Wembys and the Cooper Flags, it kind of feels like in those drafts, like, you want to be in the top two or three. And we have the generational players in this draft, at least a lot of us think so. DeBanza and Peterson is the headliners. But like you were saying, I mean, Acuff and Filon and Ament and Wagler, like, there are just so many good college players, good freshman, Caleb Wilson, that, I mean, you can have like the 9th or 10th pick this year and still get a really, really, really good player. It's going to be a loaded draft. It's a great year again for the Wizards to be terrible. Like, I know we're all excited to see the potential of next year, but, and there's a lot of ifs. There's a whole lot of ifs. Obviously, Trae Young's got to stay healthy. AD's got to stay healthy, all these types of things. But if all goes according to plan and those guys stay healthy, and again, they don't need like a top two or three pick. Would it be awesome to get those guys? Of course it would, but the depth of the lottery and how great some of those players are that you can get at pick 7, pick 9, pick 10, they're in a really good spot. And I think all these players that people are hearing about that they're hyping up, I think more of them are going to be really good than end up, you know, not being good in the NBA.
If you were in the Wizards front office and you had the number one pick, like I've gotten both of these lottery sims, are you going DeBanza or are you going Peterson, and why?
I'm going DeBanza personally because I just think he's a better fit for the Wizards. Like, I think both guys are so good and there's not a clear-cut number one. I really just think it's team dependent. I think if you're a team where you're just getting the best player available, like that's your goal, you can truly go anywhere, you need a lot of help on your roster, I think you're probably going Peterson. If you're a team like the Wizards where, like, small forward, getting a great small forward is the dream, I think you go with DeBanza. That's what the Wizards need. So I think because not only could you argue he's the best available player, but he also fits the area that you most need, I just think it's a slam dunk for the Wizards. So for me, if I was drafting, I would draft DeBanza one.
I know there's a long way to go. There's interviews, there's workouts, there's plenty of stuff. But, you know, Darren Peterson obviously had some level of, I don't know if I want to put controversy, but it became a thing with him checking out of games and whether or not he was healthy and, you know, a lot of questions about his time at Kansas. Do you look into that as a big deal? Do you look at that as a small thing? Do you think that's something that will kind of figure itself out in the pre-draft process?
Not at all. You would have liked to see him playing more games and you would have liked to see him have the competitive spirit that, you know, some of these other guys have and willing himself to play, but I don't think scouts or teams really care about that type of stuff. And he's a freshman and the talent is undeniable. I really haven't heard a lot of college coaches talk about Darren Peterson the way they talk about other players. Like so many of these coaches that faced off against Kansas this year talking about the similarities to Kobe or what a tough cover he is or just the skill oozing out of him. Like, it is unbelievable to hear all the reviews that he has gotten after facing him. So to me, that's way more telling than maybe, you know, people questioning like the work ethic or does he love basketball or will he play through injuries, be there for his team, all those sorts of things. I think with a talent like that, you just have to trust with what the film says when he's out there and what the coaches and opposing players have said when they've gone up against him.
All right, if you were to give us one name of a player that you think is going to rise up just mock drafts in the draft board at this point from what we've seen from college basketball and this point in the tournament, is there a name that you would throw out there for us?
I would say Nate Ament. I don't think he's getting thrown around right now in like the top five. or top six, maybe even top seven, but he's going to play today for Tennessee against Michigan. If people watch that game, like, you can just see at his size and length, and he's just got one of those jump shots that's kind of unguardable. You know, like, he gets to his spot, you can't block his shot type of thing. And you can tell, like, the body's there, the size is there. He's just got to grow into it, and he's just got to develop a little bit more. And when that jump shot becomes more consistent, I think he's going to be an unbelievably good NBA player. So I'll be interested to see if there's a team that takes a chance on him, because I think Ament is a guy not too much of us are talking about right now, like top five, top six. But, like, again, if the Wizards took him at that spot, would be thrilled with that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, a 6'10 wing that shot, again, only took 4 threes a game this season, but 34% from three, there's a lot of upside for that. Those big wings, I mean, it's kind of Will Riley in some ways, too. We're seeing that development of Will Riley with the Wizards, where it's that 6'10 wing with a smooth jump shot, where you just see so much upside in a young player like that. So, yeah, Ament is definitely one of those names, I think, that we could probably see, because it's some of the stuff you can't teach, right? The intangibles, the size alone, and you're like, ooh, he could grow into his body a little bit, only about 2'10. Like, there's a lot more that you could do with it. PJ Glasser, Game Day Garage, The Quad, Hoops in 5. Give him a follow on all of his socials as well. Great content throughout today. Before you go, what's on the menu today for these games? What are you eating?
Well, I'm gonna be at Cap One. I'm heading down there.
That's right. You will be there.
Whatever they've got. I'm gonna have myself a little lunch now, and then whatever the concessions are charging me. That's what I'll be having.
There you go, Peach. Good to talk to you, man. Thanks for jumping on.
Yep, thanks, Nick. Appreciate it.
There he goes. Yeah, big bad Duke today. It's that Duke UConn game I cannot wait for. But he's right. Like, this is the thing too. Like, if the lottery odds are a little iffy in terms of what the NBA is going to change in May, it's clearly coming. But I will say this: there is a lot on the board for the Wizards, even if they do, God forbid, fall a few spots in this lottery because they're smoothing things out. There's a lot of talent that they could still have in here. But yes, you want that potential franchise-altering player, and it completely changes the trajectory of this entire team. All right, Nick Ashew on the Fan. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm a sucker for cryptic stuff on social media. It gets me. Maybe not the Taylor Swift stuff. I know that's her thing, all the little Easter eggs. But, man, when the Commanders put out that video about new uniforms April 15th, even though we kind of know the gist of what a lot of it's going to be, it's the Super Bowl era uniforms. Let's just say it, the Redskins uniforms. We all know that's going to be the case. But there's going to be something that's different. They're not just going to go back to exactly what it is. I can't wait. I really. Look, wasn't it nice to see, again, a lot of bad things that happened in the season, and they didn't wear them much. But just to see them go back to the real uniforms, this is what makes this new ownership group smart, right? You're kind of mixing and blending the past with the future. Where the name, look, Redskins is not coming back. We all know that. Logo's probably not coming back. We just got to know that. It's always going to be a fight. I get it. But at some point, if this team is just winning games and they're in the uniforms that you remember from the glory days, and they're winning it with the name Commanders, are you really going to care if they're a Super Bowl contender in a brand new stadium in 2030 and they're called the Commanders? I won't. I'll be okay. Like, yes, do I miss the old name and the old everything? I mean, yeah, to a point. But for me, I also grew up in the era, and I get it, this is me, but I grew up in the era where that name really just was mostly about a dysfunctional franchise owned by Dan Snyder. I mean, yes, I was a kid that was a fan of the team before Dan Snyder bought it, but I was a young lad, and I will, admit that I don't have all of that history. My first sports memory as a little kid was my parents having a Super Bowl party, and we still lived in New Jersey. I didn't understand what the Super Bowl was, but, you got to go way back for that. But, for people that are in my generation, like, we remember 2012. That was fun. And we remember 2024. And RG3's rookie year, Jaden Daniels' rookie year. That's really all we got. So if you tell me that you got to keep the name Commanders, but they're going to be a Super Bowl contender and it's going to be a long, line of success of multiple quarterbacks and great ownership, and it becomes a franchise that people want to model their franchises after, but they're called the Commanders, are you going to make that trade? Because I am. I mean, really. It's a much better place to be. They probably have a glossy helmet, all these little things. You get that. Maybe they'll have an alternate. I know I'm in the minority. I love the idea of a black uniform. I don't really love... I've gone back and forth with this, and I've had this conversation with a lot of people. I don't love exactly what the black unis are, but I love the idea of a black uniform, and I could stick with the ones that they have, or I could alternate it, you know, or alternate, that's the right word, change the numbers and little details, it'd be fine. If they do it all black with a black helmet and a spear on the side and like the W still on the front or something, ooh, come on, that'd be kind of nasty. You got to have one uniform that's just random, right? But there was a lack of connection to this team because they changed everything, and that was stupid. They changed the name. They changed the way the uniforms look. Don't pretend that burgundy jersey was actually burgundy. It was freaking maroon. We all know it's maroon. Stop saying it's the same color code. It's not. It's not the same. But we're going to get those back. And that really helps slowly. Listen, nostalgia is a powerful drug. It really is. And it makes you look at things through a certain lens. And it makes you remember even the bad years, but still the ties to even then the good years before that. And you just go, I miss the old uniforms. It'll make people feel like this is their team again. And every team's got a weird alternate. That's fine. But I'm all for this. I think this is an opportunity for this organization now to take another step in a forward direction while still giving some of you that familiarity. They brought back the gold pants in 24. You got some of those throwback alternates. They called it Super Bowl era, whatever, last year. The full identity is going to be back this year. At least for that. Yes, the helmet will look a little different. They'll get closer. It's gonna be a process. It's really not going to be something that is instant. But it is something that's going to evolve that by the time they open that new stadium, if they are winning and that looks like the team in terms of what the uniforms and everything looks like on the field, and you've got the burgundy with the gold pants, come on, are you really going to care they're called Commanders? You're not. Every single fan is making that trade. Super Bowl contender for the name Commanders. You just are. Anybody that tells you otherwise is a liar or doesn't really care about this team. So, all right, Nick Ashew on the Fan. I've gone back and forth in terms of that number 7 pick for the Commanders between two things. Still number 1 for me if he's on the board is Sonny Styles. I would just love to see him on this roster. Would help that defense in just so many ways. David Bailey right there for me if he's still available. I mean, one of the best edge rushers in college football. But then there's also the trade down effect that could have, I mean, could do a lot for this organization too, where the hidden value of adding an extra pick, whether it's a second rounder or early third rounder, something along those lines, depending on where they are, and still picking high in the first round. You know, when you have so many needs and you need to get younger and you need to just add depth and talent in multiple areas, this could be an opportunity for the Commanders then to, let's say, again, I keep throwing this as an example because I think there's a possibility of this, like, it could fit, not saying there's any interest, but the Dolphins are going up from 11 to 7. The Commanders going down 4 spots. And if they ended up drafting Carnell Tate with that 11th overall pick and you get somebody that's great defensively in the second round because, you know, David Bailey and Sonny Styles are off the board, I could live with that because you'd be picking at 43. Maybe get yourself a linebacker like a Jacob Rodriguez, the linebacker out of Texas Tech, is somebody there. Or, you know, again, there's a bunch of names and where it falls and all that case. There's plenty of Malachi Lawrence out of UCF. Again, I'm just throwing names that could be kind of on the board in that spot. No point in listing a ton of these names. My point is here is that you can fill multiple needs here because, yes, there's no question that the Commanders do still need help offensively. I'm with you. I get it. I get why you want Jeremiah Love, but he wouldn't be part of this equation. We just have to be honest with ourselves. He ain't falling to 11. But they also do need another wide receiver, and maybe Denzel Boston's on the board in the second round, wide out of Washington. I mean, he's almost 6'4", 212. There's a lot of talk about him sort of rising up draft boards in a lot of spots too, where they could address that number two wide receiver. They could get somebody that's a great defensive player in the first round, and you're in a really good spot where then you don't even really need Brandon Ayuk, right? Because that's a thing too. I know we're sitting here and it's like, well, the inevitability is that Brandon Ayuk goes to Washington. I mean, maybe. There's a lot of talk about the 49ers being real petty with this situation. And here's the thing. It's very rare that you have an organization, a general manager, anybody, come out in any press conferences and basically just say a player's done with you. So everybody knows there's no leverage for the 49ers. They're not going to be able to trade him. Nobody's going to give you anything unless a team wants him so bad that it's like a conditional seventh round pick. There's not much value in that. I mean, maybe you find a diamond in the rough that's a depth player for you at some point. But in reality, a conditional seventh round pick, depending on what Brandon Ayuk does, that's maybe the only way that a team jumps in and just gets Ayuk. But realistically, everybody knows in the NFL that he's a dude that's going to just get released. And you know, he's given up all this money. There's all this drama around him, and everybody's got to do their due diligence and figure out what it is. But he also, if he has the freedom, has the choice, and he'll probably want to go play with Jaden Daniels. We know that. This has been a thing for a while. So if that is the case, and you're the Commanders at that point, and you've got a receiver that you really like that could be a potential, even like a development number two receiver, where you draft him in the second round, you get a second round pick, and you're like, well, he doesn't have to be our number two right away. And then you get Ayuk on a one-year deal, 1 year, $15 million. That's nothing for this team. They got plenty of cap space still, plenty of cap space. And you're in a really good spot because there's obviously going to be a level of figuring out what Brandon Ayuk is still can do on the field, having not played in 18 months, and it'll be longer by the time he's out there in camp. Low pressure for that. You draft a wide receiver that could be eventually your number two, but maybe isn't in that spot right away in terms of targets. And then you've got Terry McLaurin getting all the targets that he needs. And, you know, the backfield, maybe you draft another running back later. But you've already got a backfield with a bunch of guys that can fill roles. Maybe need more of a thumper, right? You got a bunch of pass-catching wide receivers or running backs. Bill takes that next step. That's why trading down does allow for more opportunities. You see it a lot in the NFL because, again, it's just, there's value in third-round picks. There's no third round in the NBA. Teams aren't really trading picks into the second round as much. Those are kind of development players, guys overseas. Sometimes they hit. But when you got things that you got to fill and you got needs, I think there is going to be a real chance that the Commanders actually start looking at where trading down could be valuable. But again, a lot of it is what happens at the top of the draft. Because if you have utter chaos, Arvell Reese is dropping and a team trades up for him and Jeremiah Love's still on the board, there's teams trading up for somebody like that. You just got to figure out who you have on the board and what's more valuable. Is it a drafting Sonny Styles or is it getting a second round pick if somebody wants to trade up? These are all theoretical, but you're having conversations and you're trying to figure out all these different potential scenarios that are there anyway. That's sort of part of the way this gig is. And there's a lot of teams that are very unpredictable. The Jets, unpredictable. Though I'll give them credit. They've actually been decent, other than quarterbacks, drafting. Like, they've had a decent set of drafts over the last few years. They just traded some of that talent away now because they were completely rebuilding this thing. But, you know, the Cardinals are a dysfunctional wild card, and the Titans are pretty much a mess. And I think the Giants are going to be more disciplined because John Harbaugh is going to have a massive influence on what's there. But then you even got the Browns at six. What the hell are the Browns going to do? They got a head coach that's a first-time head coach that's 100 years old, and they got a front office that's making coaching candidates write essays. They might be doing the same thing for players. You just go, who knows? They could surprise everybody. There's always one surprise early in the draft, right? A name that nobody expected to jump that high, whether it's at pick six or pick 12. There's always that one guy that you just go, whoa, did not see him going that soon. Michael Penix Jr., great example. Very extreme situation. And yeah, it can be quarterbacks sometimes. And maybe it's Ty Simpson this year. Maybe Ty Simpson, a team ends up deciding they want to trade back into the first round and they draft Ty Simpson with the 15th pick. And they trade with Tampa because they don't want the Jets to draft Ty Simpson at 16 because they got two first round picks this year and two first round picks next year. These are all scenarios. It's kind of fun, isn't it? Like, it is kind of fun to sit here and think of all these different situations that could make this absolutely chaotic. I don't see how the Commanders could probably get a second first-round pick this year. There's really no leverage for that, but there are teams that have that type of leverage. And yeah, if you're the Jets, this is why, too, trading for other picks can sometimes help you. If you're rebuilding, to have multiple first-round picks, that's good real estate, isn't it? Whether it's who you draft or packaging those together in a trade to trade up for just one first round pick or somebody that's out there on the market, or it's, you know, the Jets decide, hey, we want Myles Garrett. Here's our pick 16 this year and our second first round pick that's next year, or whatever the case is. They get really desperate and want to do that. I wouldn't do it, but, you know, these are the possibilities that can come up. So the Commanders, again, it puts them in a really good spot, but there's a lot of value in trading down. A lot of value in trading down. It just depends on where it is. I wouldn't want to see them go from 7 to 25, you know, but 7 to 11 and a second round pick, I'm just going to try to speak that into existence. I'm not saying it's actually going to happen, but love the Dolphins to be like, here's pick 11 and pick 43. We'll take it. I'm making that trade in 2 seconds if I'm the Commanders. There's a lot of value that's there. Man, NFL draft is just going to be, I cannot wait. All right, final hour coming up. We'll hear from David Harrison next. Nick Ashew on the Fan. Nick Ashew on the Fan. I'm at Nick Ashew on all of the various socials that you get there. We are less than a month away from the NFL draft. We got the Elite Eight today. Bunch of good games in the Sweet 16 over the last 2 days. Well, some of them obviously suck. That's how it works, though. Big, bad, evil Duke is still moving on. 3 straight years in the Elite Eight. A lot to get to in a two-hour show. This is going to be one of the shortest shows I've done in a while. By the way, try to say that 10 times fast. The shortest shows I've done in a while. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. We do, of course, have every single day something new when it comes to the NFL draft, and that's what makes the NFL great. That's what makes this Commanders team so intriguing, is that when you pick at 7, people care a lot more than when you pick at the end of the first round. Prefer them picking at the end of the first round, because we all know what that means. The season before was a lot better, but it is what it is. We're going to actually do something we rarely do and actually start the show right off the bat with a guest, because it is David Harrison, WSA9, Locked On Commanders, Commander Squad, which is a very good podcast, by the way, that he hosts with an absolute psychopath that wears a tinfoil hat far too often on the show. David's going to jump on with us now because he was at Ohio State Pro Day, and he's going to be going to the owners' meetings. He's literally all over the place. I know at some point you're going to be fighting the crowds at an airport, and which one it is, it doesn't matter anymore, David, because I know all of them are absolutely horrible right now. I've seen all the pictures and videos. Besides that, though, let's start with Ohio State Pro Day. You were there. You saw a lot. There's a lot of whispers about which direction the Commanders are going to go and who they're interested in. I know we got a lot of time, and it's lying season, but you know, when we look at where they are now, and listen, you and I have talked about this obviously on other shows, but for these purposes right now, you know I'm big defense. You know I'm team Sonny Styles if they can get to that point. Where we are at this point with this team, are you kind of gut offense, kind of gut defense before we dig into this a little bit of where they go at 7 at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of my mock drafts, I do one every week, so, you know, there's numerous versions of them out there, and every single one I try to go down a different path. But most of the paths I've gone down have involved a defensive player in the first round, you know, whether that be Mansoor Delane, usually in a trade back, or, you know, maybe Caleb Downs at number 7 or Sonny Styles on the rare occasion that the simulator I use allows him to get, you know, to number 7. Usually I go defense as well. And, of course, David Bailey is in that mix. Reuben Bain Jr. is someone that I'm not as high on as some people are, but, you know, you can't deny the fact that the young man is talented and certainly could be in that conversation. I think I've actually only gone offense on one mock draft, and that was Carnell Tate in a trade back. I traded back with the Bengals to number 10 and ended up getting Carnell Tate at number 10 and kind of let the board fall for me and take the best of the remaining players that I had kind of eyed at number 7, and that was who it was. And, you know, truthfully, when I went through, like, the rest of that draft, I didn't really like the way the board fell. I ended up with Chris Johnson, who's a little bit of a longer cornerback who I liked. Now, at the time, the team didn't have Akella Witherspoon either. So the prospect there was having Chris Johnson as a third round pick, you know, potentially starting opposite of Trey Amos, a second year, second round pick, and also a Mikey Sainer, still a third year, second round pick. And it's like, you know, you want eventually in some of these key areas to have some high invested talent and all that stuff. So that's a little bit part of the aesthetic of it. But I think the key is the Commanders can go any direction they want to. I think the majority of the directions they go will be defensive, but I think you have to acknowledge that there's two offensive paths that they can go, being Carnell Tate and Jeremiah Love.
I mean, they're in a really good spot sitting at 7. There's certainly going to be a lot of talent on the board there. I'm interested because when you talk about them trading back 2 spots, that's an option that's clearly on the table for them, depending on how the board shapes out and where things fall at that point. For your purposes of what you did there in that mock draft, trading back a couple of spots, you had them 10 to the Bengals. You said, what does a trade like that look like? And what would be, in your eyes, a good trade for the Commanders trading back and obviously getting more assets back, you know, in whatever rounds you have in that trade?
Yeah, I think you stick to the value charts, and I use the Rich Hill draft pick value chart just for full transparency for anybody who wants to compare notes. Whenever I do these trades, I pretty much stick to the math. I don't try to get too crazy into like the, you know, well, AP could say, well, you know, I need this much of an increase and all that stuff. Now, there are some historical taxes that, you know, that teams have had to pay. So I did one mock draft early in the offseason where I think I moved back to number 12. Or no, 12 is the Dallas Cowboys. I definitely didn't do that. But I traded back with the Jets, whatever number they are. I can't remember off the top of my head.
16.
And, you know, they're out. What's that?
Their Jets are at 16.
Yeah, so 16. So obviously they're going to pay a tax to move back into the top 10 for, you know, obviously their second top 10 pick in this scenario. And there is historical examples you can lean on to say that here's the tax amount that they would have to pay in order to do that. So obviously you get more capital from that. I've done a couple of mocks where you try to trade. There's like three teams with two second round picks this year. So it's like, what does it look like if the Commanders just trade out of the first completely, but net those two second round picks and then other packages? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, like the bottom line is the team is going to get talent. You know, they're going to get more young talent, and it's going to be indicative, you know, or it's going to be imperative that David Blau and Durante Jones have a plan for that young talent and what they do. But what I really like is adding another day two pick and keeping yourself in the first round. I think that's really that kind of sweet spot. And the great thing about, you mentioned like the Commanders are in a really good spot. And I think we talked about this on the squad show where there's just numerous amounts of talent, like Caleb Downs, Carnell Tate, Jeremiah Love, you know, David Bailey, Reuben Bain. Like there's all these players and there's tackles that, you know, the Commanders don't need, but another team might want that are going to be potentially available at number seven. And really, I think the more people that are calling you, if you're Adam Peters, the more leverage you have to bank more capital by moving down fewer spots. So obviously it's kind of a quality over quantity type of situation, right? Like if you move back to 16, obviously you're going to get, you know, maybe a future first and you're going to get a second this year and all that kind of stuff. But you might be able to get, like, let's say the Kansas City Chiefs at number nine are calling up for number seven, but so too are the Jets, the Buccaneers, the Bengals, and even the Cowboys. The Cowboys are like, hey, you know, you can't get told yes if you don't ask the question. You might be able to talk to the Chiefs and say, hey, listen, like, we know you want to move up from nine to seven, but listen, X team, they're all calling too. And here's what they're offering, and they're paying a 20% tax. You might be able to get the Kansas City Chiefs to now pay a 25% tax in order to prevent you from giving that pick to somebody else who's going to come up and not only take the player that they want, but then, you know, you're also moving back and getting what you want. Listen, Adam Peters comes from the school of John Lynch, and we've seen John Lynch execute two one-pick trade backs. And I remember the Bears and the Buccaneers, both those fan bases on draft night were like, why would my GM trade up one spot and give up everything they gave up just to move up one spot? It makes no sense. Well, it makes all the sense in the world when you realize that the reason that team right behind the 49ers spent as much as they did to move up one spot is to prevent all the other teams that were calling to jump ahead of them to come get their guy. So you also might be able to execute a one-spot trade with the New Orleans Saints and get a trade value back that might be a little bit surprising right off the cuff. But if the Saints want to move up to get, I don't know, say Carnell Tate, and if you're AP and you're like, we're not in love with Carnell Tate, so we're okay, you know, moving off that spot and letting somebody else have him. You know, the Bengals probably aren't doing it, but the Chiefs might be calling up for him. Some of these other teams might be calling up for him. You get the Saints to pay more of a tax. You move back to number eight. You get Mansoor Delane, you know, for example. I'm not saying that's what it is. The guy that you wanted anyway, but you also get draft capital. Now you get the best of both worlds. So, you know, it's part of the fun of the draft game. But I think Adam Peters comes from a really solid background in negotiators who know how to leverage their situation and their value. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what he does.
Yeah, I mean, this is the team that was devoid of talent and depth last season. So any extra pieces they can add that are, you know, early draft picks or even, you know, third or fourth round on top of that is insanely valuable to them. You know, it's what makes the movie Draft Day that much better. You watch it like, oh yeah, this is actually how it goes. This is really incredible. It's not just made for the movies. Yeah. You mentioned Reuben Bain earlier, and there's obviously a lot to be said about his arm length, which, you know, this is that time of year, right? Every little detail matters, the size of hands for quarterbacks and all the little metrics, measurables that are out there. How much stock do you put into somebody like Reuben Bain and the short arms that he has?
I think that how much stock I put into it, I think it really has to do with case study, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing about Reuben Bain is if you're trying to use him as a pure edge rusher, And really, we're talking like hand in the dirt, three-point stance type of DN. The history will show you in the NFL that I don't want to misquote here, but I think a metric. I haven't done a lot of studying on Reuben Bain Jr. Just to be honest, because I'm kind of just out on him for the Washington Commanders, which could bite me in the butt if they pick him. Then I'm like, I didn't really talk about him a lot this offseason. But that's the risk you take when you have an opinion. There was a stat out there that I saw that said no true DN, so you know three-point stance type of guy in NFL history with his arm length has recorded even a sack in the NFL. That's a pretty substantial metric. Like, yeah, it's kind of anecdotal information, but that's pretty important anecdotal information. So I think, again, it kind of comes down to the plan, right? And when you look at Reuben Bain Jr. and Durante Jones' defense, and this is where I do have to concede ground to those who are trying to, like, bash me over the head and say, hey, wake up, well, you're missing out on a dude. And I hear you, I just don't agree with you. But I do have to give credit to Durante Jones, like, the whole mantra that he's bringing in and the whole thing that Dan Quinn is bringing in and AP is bringing in is it's how you use a guy. And that's 1,000% accurate. It's how you use a guy. It's not just how much talent this guy has. I mean, if you line up Caleb Downs as a nose tackle, he's not going to do anything in the National Football League, right? And that's obviously an extreme circumstance. It's never going to happen. But it's just kind of to illustrate, like, Reuben Bain is only a three-point stance D-end for your defense. I think that the history of the NFL and the other measurables say that you're not likely to have a whole lot of success with him. If you're moving him outside and you're standing him up as an outside linebacker, time, you know, that type of thing. If you're moving him inside a little bit, take advantage of that get off and that speed and all those things, then you have that opportunity. And then even when you do kick him outside, sometimes there's games you can play, there's twists, there's stunts, there's all types of other things you can do to try to free him up. So it's not just about necessarily how talented the player is. It's more so just about how you're going to use him. The kicker that really is taking me off of the Reuben Bain thing is the Washington Commanders have like 10 or 11 D linemen already on roster right now that you can point to and say, I could really see that this guy's going to make the initial 53. So, you know, it's not to say that's never been done, but if you add a first round pick in that group, now you're talking about one of these guys that you think is a pretty strong 53 man roster candidate, probably becoming trade bait. And that's certainly a possibility, but it just typically you look at the thin areas of the roster versus the stacked areas of the roster.
All right, talking to David Harrison here on The Fan. April 15th is a very special day, my friend, because we're going to finally see the uniforms that we probably expect this team to be rolling out, that we kind of know what it's going to. It's one of these weird situations where it's like, we kind of know what you're doing, but there's like a few surprises that are still there. You know how everything is with this team. Every little detail matters. Every little piece of information that we could get, especially with this transition into new ownership and everything else. Just big picture for you. This tease they had on the uniform and what it's going to be. What do you expect, and what are maybe even some ideas or speculations you have and some of the things they're going to add?
Yeah, I think it's the Super Bowl era uniform, right? Mm-hmm. The one that we saw last year, the white jersey version. I think that's just going to get solidified this year as a permanent uniform. And I think that you're going to have your burgundy version. And then the question there is what color are the pants, you know? And you're going to have multiples. Like, you might have a burgundy on burgundy version, and a burgundy and white, a white and burgundy, a white and gold, burgundy and gold. You know, you're going to have all these different versions and mixed matches that they can do. I think the real question, the real mystery this offseason regarding the uniform is the alternate. And I don't know that April 15th is the date that everybody's going to find out that alternate. And I think that's where, like, there's going to be a point. So there's an obvious point of contention, which is going to be a point of contention for a very long time that, you know, is a little bit silly to still kind of argue about, but it just is what it is. And that's, you know, is it going to be the W and all that stuff? And nothing is indicating that it's going to be anything but I have seen some ideas from some of these, like, fan mock-ups, which I think fans do a really great job, and some of these graphic designers out there do a really great job of some of these mock-ups. Like, Nike might want to start paying attention, maybe hire some of these folks. But I saw one where it's like they kept the W, but they put a border on it, and I think it makes it look a lot cleaner. So I wouldn't mind seeing something like that. I don't think it's coming. And then, obviously, there's the rumor of, you know, the helmets going back to glossy. I know there was, I think it was the Caleb on Chase on introductory video where he walks through the equipment room and there's a nice glossy burgundy helmet sitting there. So everybody's like, oh, the new helmet's going to be glossy just like the old one was. And some people love it, some people hate it. But like I said, I think the alternate's the real mystery. And the alternate doesn't have to be unveiled before the NFL draft, whereas the permanent uniform has to be unveiled before the NFL draft. So I would like it. I would appreciate it if the team would unveil just everything, the alternate uniform included, on the same day. But, you know, just kind of living in my world of what ifs. Like, it's not mandatory, it's not required, so it may not happen.
What do you think about a spear? You think that's incorporated at all?
I love it. I hope so. If there's no spear, you got a lot of explaining to do. Like, you know, not trying to talk to you like you're Lucy, but like, you know what I mean? Like, you've been sporting the spear pretty heavily for a couple of years now, and you got the crest logo and the circular, you know, logo with the cross spears and the videos and Daryl Green in a game, you know, stomping the spear and getting everybody hyped up. Like, that spear has obviously become a very important part of the brand imagery. So yeah, I mean, you expect a spear somewhere, you know, whether it's like a helmet. I know a lot of people who are Florida State fans would just love, you know, they're Florida State fans and they're Commanders fans, so they would love to have kind of that little crossover connection type of deal. But yeah, I think the spear on the alternate uniform would look cool. Listen, you know, I've been against the black uniform.
I know.
I'm not even against, because it's a weird thing. Like, I'm not gonna like stand on the corner with a sign, you know, about the black uniform. But I haven't been a fan of like the lettering. I haven't been a fan of, or the numbering rather. I haven't been a fan of the logo on the front. But I'll say right now, if you put spears on the side of that helmet, even if you keep that logo on the front, I'm still not going to like it, but I think it looks a lot better. So I think that the alternate is the big thing. And yeah, I think the spear needs to be part of that, you know, part of that image.
Well, you know my take. Every team should have an all-black uniform, but I'm fine with tweaks to the current one that they have. That's fine, but all-black with the spear on the helmet, ooh, man, I'd love it. The cryptic stuff gets me, man. All these little Easter eggs. I know Taylor Swift has perfected it, and people are just like, hey, she's trying to – it works. It works. We all talk about it. We all get interested, like you pointed out in these videos. It gets us every time. David Harrison, really good to talk to you, buddy. Locked on Commanders, Commanders squad. I mean, WSA9, literally everything is as connected to the team as there – anybody there is in this market. Good to talk to you, buddy. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate you.
All right, there he goes. Yeah, I know I'm in the minority, but I've said this since the beginning. I like the black uniforms. They could be better, but I at least you got to have all black uniform. Every team in every sport, all the way across the board. That's what you got to have. All right, Nick Ashew on the Fan. Nick Ashew on the Fan. You can tweet me at Nick Ashew. I will stay tweet, and it's Twitter forever. It'll never be X for me. I did get a tweet from someone that did bring up a suggestion here from Mike. Pretty simple and straightforward there. Brian Thomas Jr., who's kind of fallen out of favor for the Jags as a wide receiver at this point now. I mean, it's another option. It's going to cost you more a wide receiver. But, you know, that's something to think for the Commanders, too. If they don't find a receiver and they don't want to wait on Brandon Ayuk, that could be a scenario there. It's just going to cost you a lot more. He's 23. But, you know, you got Travis Hunter coming back for the Jags. Jacoby Myers and Parker Washington tended to get more targets from Trevor Lawrence. I don't know why, like, if you're the Jags, you'd give up on Brian Thomas this soon, especially after the rookie season that he had. But obviously it's a new offense now. If you're Liam Cohen, though, you find a way to make this work. But his name's been thrown around as somebody that's kind of been on the trade market. It would cost the Commanders more. Again, like, everything comes down to cost, right? Everything comes in life. It's the same thing in the draft. It's the same thing in free agency. It's the same thing in trades. All of it is based on what that costs look like. And, you know, some teams like the Rams have just said the cost of doing business is F them picks. We're going to go all in on this year. And, you know, if you really look at the NFC as a whole, I look at the NFC and just go, who do you trust? The Rams are the best team right now in the NFC. Now, that's on paper, and we know how that works in the NFL. It doesn't guarantee everything. But let's take injuries out of the equation right now. I mean, if you're looking at the NFC, Seattle lost a ton on defense and their offensive coordinator. So that's a problem already right off the bat. A lot of questions around Seattle. That was the one seed in the NFC. Well, the two seed, that was Chicago. That's a head coach in his first year and a quarterback that you haven't seen in that type of offense yet. Oh, by the way, Caleb Williams had games where he looked still atrocious and was wildly inaccurate. But do you trust the Bears at 11-6 last year to be a team that takes that next step? I mean, it could be them. Remember, Seattle just ran away with the NFC last season. Philadelphia's got all its issues, not just with A.J. Brown and whether they're going to trade him, but just in general, right? Head coach, kind of a troll, lost in the first round, offense, Jalen Hurts, I mean, a million different things going on there. The four seed was Carolina, so we just know they made the playoffs by default. We'll just kind of rule them out of this. But, I mean, the Rams won 12 games last year. Matt Stafford stays healthy again this year after the you know, adding a couple of big-time corners this offseason, going full FM picks, leaning in on a chance now to win the NFC. The Rams, after winning 12 games last year, are your best team in the NFC as of right now. And San Francisco, yes, was also a 12-win team. That division's massively competitive, but if you're looking at the 49ers, Trent Williams, you're dealing with contract and bonus, and it's messy and still kind of unresolved there. He's always – oh, doesn't it feel like Trent Williams is always fighting about his contract, like, every single season? I mean, I get it. Go get yourself paid, but there's a certain point where you look around going, like, when is this going to stop? It's always something. Plus, he's, what, 37, getting older. The 49ers have been dealing with more and more injuries. Mike Evans was their big sign this offseason, but he's 33, and, you know, he's on the decline in his career. And the 49ers are already dealing with age, and they were – had the fewest sacks in the entire NFL last year. Again, why I think Myles Garrett would make a ton of sense in San Francisco. But again, that's what we're talking about as the top of the NFC right now. Massive questions across the board with all of these teams. Green Bay was 9-7. Minnesota, are they better with Kyler Murray? I actually think Kyler Murray is going to do pretty well in that Kevin O'Connell offense because he's going to start. It's not J.J. McCarthy. They're not going and signing Kyler Murray if they want J.J. McCarthy to be their starter. So you just rule that out. Detroit missed the playoffs last year. Do they rebound from that? Yeah, they had new coordinators. That was a problem for them. Does Tampa take a jump back up after going 8-9? They've cycled through offensive coordinators. Then they lose Liam Cohen, and that's the last one. It's like, have the Bucs already peaked? The Falcons, they've got some talent, new head coach. I think the Falcons could take a jump only because I think Kevin Stefanski is a really good coach. He cleaned up a lot of messes in Cleveland. Dallas, New Orleans. I mean, again, these are all the teams that were ahead of the Commanders. And I just look at the NFC right now and see a lot of – there's a lot of vulnerability. Because the AFC really is different only because you have a lot of continuity from last season to this year. Right? You trust the Broncos with an elite defense. Bo Nix is healthy. They add Jalen Waddle. They could win another 14 games next year. The Patriots went to a Super Bowl and addressed issues on the offensive line and the offense in general this offseason. Drake May was a runner-up to win MVP and in the regular season was just terrible in the playoffs, but they've got a great defense. Jacksonville might be well-coached. We'll see. We've seen coaches take over, and they're great head coaches their first year, and then things fall apart in year two. So there's certainly a level of, like, around Jacksonville. You don't know what you're going to get with the Steelers because the quarterback situation and new head coach. Don't know what you're going to get with the Texans. There's high end with C.J. Stroud, and there's a low end. The Chargers won 11 games last year. Maybe they take another jump under Harbaugh. Colts started off 7-1. The Ravens could be better. You've at least got the quarterback situation settled there. Do they stay more healthy? New head coach. A lot there. I mean, again, if you're looking at the AFC, it is loaded with quarterback, too. And that's the thing. It's a lot of young teams with good quarterbacks that could be in these positions for years to come. Like, I look in the NBA, and it's like the Thunder and the Spurs, and they could be rivals for the next 7-8 years with all the young talent they have, and there's a lot there. It's the same thing in the AFC. The West is loaded in the NBA. The AFC is loaded in the NFL. But the NFC is very vulnerable. And it does give you at least a sense of hope. There's always multiple factors for a team taking a big jump from one year to the other. We know all the things that factored into the Commanders winning 12 games 2 years ago. This past season, we know all the factors that came into them only winning 5 games. And there was a lot. But it could bounce back the other direction for them. Again, I'm not saying the Commanders are like a top three team in the NFC, but what I am saying is the top three in the NFC is very vulnerable. And Seattle could still be good. I mean, this could all be a moot point. We look back and Seattle wins another 12 games or whatever, and they're still the number one seed in the NFC. But they just were so far above and beyond everybody else when it came to wins alone. And I know that's not the only factor because then you've got division races and things along those lines. But, I mean, think of what we're talking about in the NFC West. Think of what we're talking about with teams like Seattle, San Francisco, and the Rams. It's like, whew, it's loaded. That's the best division in football right now. Like, that's really what this comes down to. Is that when you're looking at that NFC, Seattle won 14 games. The Rams and 49ers won 12. There's a reason why Arizona was so far behind. So it all kind of goes through the NFC West right now. It certainly doesn't go through the NFC South. We know that. But NFC East, very vulnerable. Eagles, very vulnerable. Cowboys won 7 games last year, and they were second in the NFC East. Washington healthy is at least a 7-win team this past season. They were bad, but they were exposed with their lack of depth and lack of speed, and they were older. So that's part of the problem. But it's a very vulnerable division in the NFC East, and it's a very vulnerable conference in the NFC right now, where it's the NFC West and everybody else. And again, even the 49ers. You're scratching your head going, I mean, when does the bottom fall out with them? Testament to the coaching and the, you know, it's the talent they do have there, but Christian McCaffrey's only getting older. You might have to use him a little more as a wide receiver moving forward. That's a thing. So, again, a lot to go. We're sitting here in March, but the draft can reposition some of these things. Commanders at least in a good spot. You gotta feel better than last year. I know that. So, all right, final segment coming up. Nick Ashew on the Fan. Nick Ashew on the Fan. We got March Madness coverage coming up again today. Duke and UConn playing at 5. Oh, so much today. So much. I love it. Tennessee, Michigan will be the earlier game as well. So, you know, it's funny, too, if you look at where Duke is versus where North Carolina is. Isn't it funny how, like, the post the guy era for their head coaches has gone completely different? Hubert Davis is gone. John Shire's worked out Duke. They're in their third straight Elite Eight. And look, it's hard to be the guy that follows the guy, right? Whether it's the guy that has to be the new face of the NBA or the guy that becomes the new head coach of Duke after Coach K retires or Roy Williams leaves North Carolina. And you're looking around going, it ain't easy. I mean, I remember the Lakers years ago struggling trying to figure out who was going to, you know, be the next head coach after Phil Jackson. And they went through a bunch of coaches, Mike D'Antoni and Mike Brown. And, you know, it was a long list. Luke Walton, I think. I mean, it was just like coach after coach. We've seen it. And it's still going on, right? Look at Alabama post Nick Saban. Kalen DeBoer's had a level of success, but hasn't been Nick Saban's success. Then again, fans wanted Nick Saban fired if he wasn't winning a national championship every single year. So again, you're in a guy's shadow no matter what. I'll tell you this though, if there's one coach that makes sense, his name's been thrown around, Billy Donovan with the Bulls. I mean, at what point do you just get tired of mediocrity? I mean, the Bulls are a team that's they can't even get to the play-in tournament this year now. Why? Like, at what point? I understand that college basketball has changed and, you know, some of these coaches have actually found that coaching in the pros, whether it's the NFL or the NBA, it's a little bit more beneficial because you're not dealing with the constant level of recruiting and some of the other moving parts versus the having a front office and, you know, free agency and those types of things in the NBA and the NFL. But here's the thing. College programs are building full front offices now. We have general managers. It's not just like an athletic director and a bunch of coaches. They're building full-on front offices in college sports, especially basketball and football. Obviously, the size of the program matters, but you get to these spots where you look around and go, if you have experience as a head coach in the NBA or the NFL and you want to go down to college, you do what I mean, Bill Belichick did it, right? He started building a front office there in North Carolina on the football side. Now, has it worked? No, but that's a whole other conversation. So it's not like it's one of those things these coaches are like, oh, God, I hate what college basketball is now. Yeah, but if you're coaching in the NBA like Billy Donovan, do you want to continue to be a part of mediocrity with the Bulls and eventually get fired because at some point they got to do something new in Chicago? Or do you want to go and be the guy that follows the guy that wasn't good at following the guy? Did you follow that? Do you understand what I mean? Right? Like, at this point, Billy Donovan going in, he's going to be a hero because the expectations are much lower around North Carolina after Hubert Davis than where they were with Roy Williams. Now, North Carolina's got to kind of lean in a little bit more to some of the one-and-dones. I know they've had some. Caleb Wilson's going to be gone. He's going to the NBA, probably a top-five pick. He was hurt. You know, so it's not like they're not going after top McDonald's All-Americans and recruits that can go in there and do plenty for them, but Duke leaned into it a lot more, and as storied as that rivalry is, like, Duke has had the advantage post-legendary head coach leaving, right? It's not easy. Again, it's also a testament to what Duke has built. They're recruiting John Shire, getting groomed to be in that position, and Hubert Davis was on the coaching staff for North Carolina for years, too, so it's not like they weren't prepared for this to be a thing, but it just hasn't worked out, and that's it's not easy. The expectations are what they already are, and then you know, on top of that, it's harder to recruit when the program's not doing as well, and maybe you're not paying as much for recruits as some other schools would. I mean, Houston, that's a top basketball program, and they're talking about how broke they are, right? They're like, we need more money. Well, it's not that easy. But, I mean, we got three of the four number one seeds in the Elite Eight right now. And this is what college basketball still needs. And we can talk about parity all we want, but you want parity with the top programs. You don't want to have an NCAA tournament where the Final Four is an 8 seed, a 6 seed, a 13 seed, and a 5 seed. It doesn't happen much, but it has happened. Now, the last couple of years have been different. We talked to PJ Glasser, obviously, earlier, you know, and it's still too early to really tell what the evolution of college basketball is going to be, but it's definitely different. It's definitely different. And look, there's going to be a level of leveling off, if you will. It's been a long day. I don't know if there's going to be a salary cap, but they're going to come up with something to get NIL at least a little bit more under control. But how much can you really do it? Especially once the government gets in. They're like, yeah, we don't care about our airports or all the other stuff going wrong, but if it's sports, we're in. Yeah, we want to parade our faces out there so we can show we care about the sanctity of sports. No, you just want to distract everybody from all the other disasters going on and all the things that you're screwing up. But, you know, the government's going to get involved in this too, and it's a whole thing. It's going to continue. And, you know, three of the four number one seeds still in, this is good. We had Iowa, they're out. We have Tennessee today. We'll see if they win. And, you know, this is good. This is enough for March Madness. And, you know, it'll be different in other years when you have a huge collection of stars that's smaller, right? This tournament has a bunch of players, whether it's players that are still in the tournament or players that are no longer in it but were in the discussion, that are going to be at the top of a lot of draft boards. And the NBA draft is loaded with talent, we know that, but that translates over because people start hearing these names early, they're familiar with some of them, and AJ DeBanza, Darren Peterson, Cameron Boozer, whatever the case is. And that makes these games more interesting just from an individual star perspective. The NBA is a star-driven league. Basketball, it really sounds really, you know, basic, but you actually see these players' faces versus football. I know it sounds basic, but it's true. So people get a little more familiar with the face. They get familiar with these kids and what they could be. Let's run a quick Wizards sim here because we got like 2 minutes left in the show. Oh, damn it, the Pacers won it this time. Ooh, Pacers. So the first two times during the show I've run a lottery sim. And the lottery odds are going to change. I'm scared about that. Wizards had the number one pick the first two times. Now it's the Pacers. Let's do another. Just for fun. Ooh, Wizards fell to fourth. So they went from 1-1 to 5-4. So, but again, even at number four, if the Wizards were to draft at four, Caleb Wilson's on the board, Darius Acuff. I know he doesn't really fit. If you're outside of top two or three, if you're the Wizards, actually, I'd argue the top two, maybe even number one. You just take the best player available. You figure out the rest of the roster. If you have to decide between Darren Peterson and AJ DeBanza, he probably fits the Wizards a little bit more. A 6'9 wing, yeah. But, I mean, Darren Peterson, you're in a good spot with, too. I'm going to run one more just for the hell of it because we're running out the clock here for the next couple minutes. Ooh, they fell to fourth again. Caleb Wilson's interesting. So the last two of these mocks here, the Wizards have had Caleb Wilson. That's a 6'10 rim runner that fits in today's NBA. And again, if you're the Wizards and you're looking at where this draft is going to be, some of it also is don't worry about what the roster looks like now. Don't worry about how Alex Sarr fits with Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis, he ain't going to be around long term. And they'd be stupid to sign him to an extension. He'd be like 36 by the time that extension's done anyway. Trae Young, it's a little different. You know what I've said, don't sign him to an extension. Look how much better the Hawks have been actually after he left. They won, 11, 12 games? That double-digit win streak after he was gone? I'm just saying, he doesn't make teams better. But for now, it's fine. You know, Caleb Wilson would maybe not be as flashy, but you still have somebody that serves a major purpose, and you've got two young bigs and an Alex Sarr and a Caleb Wilson, if that's the case. Ooh, this one they fell to sixth. I did it again. Keaton Wagler, though. You're getting a little swing, man. That works. So this is, yeah, now who knows even what these odds are going to look like moving forward. Oh, the Mavs got the number one pick in this one. Can you imagine if the Mavericks got another number one pick, Cooper Flagg and then Darren Peterson? This is the thing, too. If the NBA wants to change these odds and you're going to smooth it out and talk about the top five teams having equal or whatever, this could, whatever they decide on in May, you can't, if you have a team jump and it's a team that really does, like the Warriors jump up and they've got a great, you know, a pick in the top five or something along those lines, people are going to be mad. There's already plenty of conspiracy theories out there. The Wizards had the first two. I'm falling to 4 and 5 a lot on this. I'm sorry. I don't want to put that out in the universe. 4, 5, and 6. These are the current odds, though, so this could be different. I'm trying to get one more before the end of the show. We got a minute left, and I just want to see the Wizards end with a number one overall pick. Top three, here's a Cameron Boozer. So there. We're going to be doing this a lot. The good thing is, though, this draft is still loaded with a lot of players that can make a difference. It's just where the high end really is. There we go. Boom. Done. I got a Wizards number one overall pick, A.J. DeBanza. Darren Peterson number two to the Pacers. Cameron Boozer number three to the Grizzlies. Caleb Wilson to the Mavs at four. Kingston Fleming's five to the Nets. We're done. That's it. I'm leaving it at that, which is good because we have a minute left in the show anyway. So we're going to put that into the universe. A.J. DeBanza to the Wizards. And keep in mind, too, if that were to work out that way, they do become more of a free agent destination. You're a big market. It shows that the rebuild is about young talent and longevity. You start to show that, hey, this team is actually about winning, not just playing for the 8 seed. And then maybe you start pulling in some real free agents there. That's how you show. You just have to show credibility as an organization and as a plan. Because it's one thing to just be like, let's keep giving Bradley Beal extensions. That never worked. Everybody saw that coming from a mile away. Oh, wait, now that he's treated the team like an ATM and he's gotten all the max deals that he could get, then he's okay getting traded. Shocker. That's how this thing works. But now, it's hard to bank on the lottery, but if there's ever a year to do it, this is the year that you do it with whatever the NBA actually does. So, you know, what do we got? We got March Madness coming up on here, right? The coverage coming here. Say it in my ear. Let me know. Nationals, I don't know. I don't look at the schedule. Nats baseball is coming up next. Of course, there is March Madness throughout the day. Good luck with all of your brackets. I'm Nick Ashew on the Fan.